I'm really excited to hear Anne read. We've worked together here for a while now, and I just keep finding out more and more wonderful and interesting things about her, and she's got incredible tights. And here we go. We have a Anne McArdle's life is like a picket fence, a stove in section here, a missing picket there, Tom Sawyer headed toward it with a bucket of whitewash. Anne McArdle.
So I'm going to read some excerpts from my memoir. Hi, you guys. In progress. It's about the time I spent in Uruguay. I was in 1969 when I was 22. I married my Latin lover, who was also 22, but he looked 42. So everybody thought I was so exotic. And we went to his home for a three-month honeymoon. And because of the situation there in the country and in his family, we kept extending our stay, and it was 3 years before we got home. So a lot of things were going on down there, so I started writing about them 50 years later. The things that you should know to be able to follow these excerpts, the urban guerrillas that were active at the time were called themselves Tupamaros, and that's a name that they came up with from the last indigenous Incan chief was Tupac Amaru, so they took that on as the name. And it became illegal to say that word in Uruguay. You could get chucked into jail for saying it. So that's enough to get us started. The title, the working title, is Tupamaros, because now that it's not illegal, I just want to say it. And I'm starting with our arrival at my in-law's house. We finally arrived, unannounced, at the big brick house on Santiago Gadea, with its red tile roof and iron grates on the picture windows. We rang the bell. Serge's brother Pablo, a very young 16, answered. Mi esposa, Serge said, putting a possessive arm around me. Pablo spun on his heel and walked away without a word, leaving us standing in the grand entryway. I looked at Serge. He's shy, but just wait a minute. And it was merely seconds before his mother streamed from the back of the house like a locomotive in high heels, screeching and laughing and smothering Sergio with hugs and kisses. And then it was my turn. I clutched my now tired bridal bouquet, a single red poinsettia. It was December, by the way. Serge had decided not only to keep our travel plans secret from his family, but also not to tell them we were getting married. The bouquet was my attempt to include my mother-in-law in the ceremony she had missed. But holding onto it for more than 24 hours, juggling carry-on baggage and seeping exhaustion in crowded planes and terminals, took its toll. So badly bruised and wilted, all that remained was the gesture. Para usted, I said, holding it out to her. That was all I could say in Spanish at that time. She took it and smiled at me, set it on the table that still bore the remains of the dishes from the midday meal, and turned back to Serge, and they resumed their barrage of words I didn't understand. I don't think he told her its significance. Poinsettias grow on trees, did you know? Big spreading trees of big red flowers in December in Uruguay, in my mother-in-law's back garden. Marta, that's my mother-in-law, sat down at the telephone table talking while she dialed. There was no doubt when the line connected, the decibel level rose again. Serge took me outside to walk the gardens. The backyard was like a park, sprawling and perfectly laid out. However, it was far from manicured, and as we strolled the paved walkways that wound among the plantings, Serge grew increasingly sad. The lawn was overgrown. Weeds filled in between the calla lilies and sabine and the beds that bordered the patio with the fish pool. The pool itself was scummy and clogged with dead leaves and twigs. No fish, no fountain burbling. Maja, The German shepherd followed us past lemon trees and figs bearing fruit, jasmine trees and mimosa, and one tree with large red blossoms. "And you didn't tell me you had a dog either," I said. Serge's father, awakened from his siesta by the din inside, appeared in the garden. He wore a navy blue wool beret in spite of the heat and was making his way slowly. His left side wobbled as a result of his stroke, but he managed to haul his leg forward while leaning heavily on his cane. But his face was alight with eagerness to hug his son again. His love overflowed onto me as he welcomed me in English, so happy to have us there. We three linked arms and made our way back to the house. Now Marta was on the phone with her sisters. Word spread, and there came a great gathering at Santiago Gadea, a Christmas Eve welcome home for Sergio, and congratulations and viewing of the foreign bride. Relatives and neighbors poured in. One after another, they shook my hand, kissed my cheeks, hugged me, and looked me in the eyes as if searching for something. Did they think because I didn't speak their language that I couldn't see them staring at me like that? And no matter how loudly they spoke or how clearly they enunciated, I could not understand. I smiled and smiled and smiled. Serge stood by me for a while. "She says, welcome to the family. She says, you're so tall. She says, you're so skinny." Over and over, "Ay, que alta, ay, que flaca." Soon enough, they would all call me La Flaca, the skinny one. It wasn't a compliment. The neighbor from across the street was known as El Holandés because he was born in Holland, though he had lived in Montevideo since he was a child. But he spoke Spanish with an awkward accent, which everyone assumed was an affectation. So though his grammar and syntax were impeccable and his vocabulary more than sufficient, people said his Spanish wasn't very good. The Dutch guy, Serge's translation for me, also spoke English and tried to engage me in a conversation. He brayed, "What do you think of Chappaquiddick, Ted Kennedy, leaving that girl to die? What was her name?" He had a kind of smirk and puffed out his chest as he waited for my response. His eyes darted left and right, checking to see if the others were taking note. I bristled, surprising myself with feelings of loyalty. "Oh, yes, well, I don't like to think about that," I said, trying to smile. Serge's brother, Pedro, whose English was also very good, came to my rescue. "And these are our next-door neighbors, Rivera and Gloria." Rivera was a huge man with a bright face, strong white teeth, and sparkling eyes. He gave me a bone-crushing hug. "Handkerchief," he said. It was the only English word he knew. His Mexican wife elbowed him aside, laughing and blinking rapidly. She gave me an equally warm hug and said in a husky, rapid-fire English, "Ignore him. You and I will talk later." She smelled like flowers and fresh air. I stood with my brand new husband in his childhood home. He inhaled deeply the smell he hadn't realized he had missed. "Home, home," he said. Through the open windows, the scents from the garden, lemon and fig and jasmine trees, from the street, eucalyptus trees and diesel fumes, and from the kitchen, adobo spices and dulce de leche, the lingering odors of bulletproof cafe and much reused cooking oil. "Not my home, not my home," I thought. So then we skip forward in time a little bit. We had already been pushing back our departure because of my father-in-law's declining health. Golpe de Estado, they called it. We use the French, coup d'etat. In both languages, it is a blow. They explained it to me. Civil rights are suspended. I knew I had civil rights, but they had always been an intangible fact of my life. Wasn't exactly certain what suspending them might feel like. No vote, no right to bear arms, no right to worship openly. I did none of these things anyway. It didn't seem like a big deal, especially after all the things I had already lost. Freedom to work, freedom to drive a car, freedom to speak and be understood, freedom to be alone with my husband, freedom to go to the library and take out a book in my language, freedom to turn on the radio and find music I like, freedom to ask a stranger directions, freedom to get from one place to another by myself, freedom to order in a restaurant and know what I can expect to get, freedom to drink plain old American coffee and smoke Marlboro filter cigarettes, freedom to use a washing machine and dryer and a steam iron and an ironing board, freedom to shop in a supermarket. I wasn't sure what other freedoms they would take away that might affect me as much. I learned. So then we stopped postponing by dribs and drabs, and we decided that we would stay there, get jobs, and kind of live there for a while instead of just be visiting and sitting around waiting. So we got jobs teaching at the Uruguayan American School, which was my savior. It was full of Americans. It was full of people who spoke my language. It was my people. And there was a library full of books. Why didn't I know this was here before? And eventually we got our own apartment and a car as well. In the school, there were some American teachers, but the American kids were children of embassy personnel and military and even some missionaries. They said that Tupamaros were getting leprosy, that it was somehow related to their spending time in the sewers, their escape routes in the city. I found the military, los milicos, more scary than the Tupamaros. Their peasant accents were hard for me to understand. If they stopped me and shouted an order, which they often did, I would have to hope they would understand my accent as I told them I didn't understand. Yo soy americana, I would say. No entiendo mucho. I would ask them to speak slowly so I could understand. Only once was I touched by a bayonet, rusty looking and thrust at my chest by a young man with a dark and sullen face behind a black caterpillar of a mustache. He was a man with authority and not much else, except this rifle with its weathered bayonet. But El Milico was not appeased. Sorry, I cut out a little piece so that transition doesn't make any sense. He was in a war, which would continue no matter what the outcome of this encounter. He did finally allow me to produce my passport, which then put him at ease. More than once, we were delayed on our way to work, stopped by armed milicos and forced to stand at the side of the road as they dismantled the seats of our 1929 Chrysler, checking for hidden arms. Of course, they were working to protect those of us who were not Tupamaros, yet like our own government's actions under the Patriot Act, this protection felt more like assault. Let me tell you who I am. Please, before you shoot me, you should know. I am not a Tupamaro. I am not a rebel. I am not your enemy. Or at least, I was not, until you threatened me with your old rifle that might or might not misfire, that might or might not kill me, that might instead kill you with its blowback shot to your own face. Until you thrust it in my chest, waved it in my face, we were not enemies. But now, you see, I will tell you who I am, and as I do so, I will disarm you figuratively. And then I will disarm you literally, and then I will show you in a way you will understand. I will show you what exactly it is you are doing with your weapon and your authority and your fear. Then you must tell me before I shoot you. You must tell me who you are. Tell me of your wife at home caring for 4 small children and cleaning houses for rich ladies when the older children return from school to take care of their baby siblings. And tell me how she cries at night when you bring home your meager pesos that buy less by half than they did last week, and how your windows are covered with cardboard in winter to stop the drafts that blow through the cracks, and how you are wearing today one of the two pants and shirts you've worn each day since you turned 21 6 years ago, and how your wife washes them each night when you arrive home and hangs them to dry so you can wear one pair, then the other, one day, then the other, except when it rains and the clothes can't dry, which happens most days in July and August, and you put them on damp in the morning and head out to work. You would get wet as you walk in the rain anyway, and all day you will be standing in that rain, hoping you don't get shot, blocking traffic and searching cars, riding hunched in the back of a Jeep to the next neighborhood where you will search the houses, hoping you find nothing, so you can go home at the end of the day to your wife and your four small children and the two older ones who help her with the babies. My math class of 6 8th graders meets in the foyer of the once grand home that is now our makeshift school. The blackboard is brown wrapping paper I've taped on the huge mahogany double doors. My numbers bend around the curves of the ornate carving beneath the paper. Danny raises his hand and blushes when I call on him. Lisa and Mary giggle. I give them a frown and wait for Danny to speak. "He likes your legs," Lisa says, and the class bursts into laughter. Everyone but Danny. I try to come up with a way to help him through this moment, but before I have a chance, our blackboard is ripped in two as the director of the school pushes open one side of the entry and strides into the room. He laughs with us when he sees what he's done, but I know him well. His face is surface. He turns his back to the class. His laugh is surface. His gray face close to mine. "Keep teaching," he says. No bells. No one leaves the building. "Okay," I say. "Are you all right?" "They've kidnapped three Americans. Danny's dad is one. They might come after the kids. Just stay inside and keep teaching." It was July 31, 1970, when they kidnapped Dan Mitrione. The other two diplomats were tossed unhurt out of cars onto the roadside later that same day. But the Tupamaros had other plans for Mitrione. In August, we learned he had been killed. In my letter home, I assured my parents, quote, "You shouldn't worry for 1 second about us. We are in no danger." This was much surer than I remember feeling. The day Mitrione was kidnapped, I wanted my mother. I wanted to be one of the children being sheltered from the horror, not one of the adults who was charged with protecting them. I still had no understanding of the real horror. Who was Dan Mitrione, and what was his work in Uruguay? As the country reeled with unrest, the government passed a law requiring visas for all foreigners who remained in the country for more than 3 months. Montevideo was suddenly brimming over with illegal aliens, including me, but thousands of them had been legal residents in Uruguay for decades. The result was a line for blocks around the municipio, which is the town hall kind of thing, newly deemed illegals queuing up like shoppers on Black Friday with lawn chairs and sleeping bags as the deadline to secure visas loomed. Even the most elderly Italian immigrants who had made a life in Uruguay were reduced to standing in the street in the cold damp of winter, hoping to make it into the municipio before it closed for lunch, or for siesta, or for another day. People spent several nights sleeping on the sidewalks, hoping their turn would come before the deadline and the threatened sweep of illegals. I chose not to. I couldn't imagine that I could be punished when their own system made it nearly impossible to comply. Sometime after the deadline, when the queues were a thing of the past, I took a cab to the municipio. Serge did not accompany me. My footsteps echoed as I mounted the marble stairs and entered the empty office that handled the visas. "I am neither here legally, nor can I leave legally. How shall we fix this?" I asked in careful Spanish, handing my passport to the clerk. His eyes roamed my face and down as far as he could see over the counter. With a greasy smile, he produced a card that solved my dilemma. "Ah, si," he said, placing a stamp on the card with a flourish. Just like that, I had the credential I needed to leave the country. "Muchas gracias, señor," I said, and left in a hurry, breaking into a run when I got to the stairs. The next weekend, we crossed the river to Buenos Aires, Argentina, and re-entered Uruguay on Sunday. The new stamp on my passport now gave me 3 legal months, at the end of which we would return to BA for another weekend and another 3-month reprieve. At about the same time, they stopped selling tampons in Uruguay. I went from farmacia to farmacia, buying up whatever stock remained, and then there were none. Since the Uruguayan tampons have been called by their brand name, we didn't know what to ask for in BA. I waited in the car while Serge went into the pharmacy with that little problem to solve. His face was crimson when he returned. He tossed a box of tampons at me. Success. The word for tampons, he had learned after a graphic and embarrassing conversation with a woman pharmacist, was tampones. Our tri-monthly visa renewal trips became tampon runs as well. I would take a large empty suitcase and return with it full of tampons for me and the other teachers in the school. The customs agents looked chagrined, more often than not, quickly zipping shut the suitcase with a look as if they'd walked into a room full of naked women. In my letter home dated July 31, 1971, I explained that Pablo was still trying to finish high school. Quote, although there are hardly ever classes because of demonstrations and riots. And as we get closer to November and the elections, things get worse and worse. General strikes are very common now. This is a time when everything stops. However, the people here are so easygoing that when they strike, instead of spending the day in protest, they go to the beach. And then, you've probably heard of the preposterous things that have been happening here. The number two man of the Tupamaros escaped from prison by walking out the front door at the end of visiting hours. And just last night, 38 Tupamaras escaped from the women's prison by crawling through a 51-foot tunnel that led into the sewer system. Then, they're trying to oust the president now, which may be pushing him to declare himself a dictator, which in turn will lead to revolution. We're registered with the embassy so that we won't miss out on any evacuation if it becomes necessary, so don't worry about us. A handwritten P.S. follows the typewritten letter. I guess I blew it holding this letter too long. Now there's another mail strike. So, thank you. And now, I would like to introduce Amanda Cook, who is one of the star teachers and staff people at the Gloucester Writers' Center. I don't think it would exist without all that she does. She's an amazing person and an amazing writer, and she has an amazing husband. And I have a little... You're going to tell them about this little book, right? Okay, so I'm just going to read one of her little mini bios. Amanda Cook can call mourning doves by whispering into the wind. Her work quiets even the most opinionated men. Her latest project, a commentary on the dailiness of life, is a multimedia piece including textiles, words, coffee cups, songs sung under her breath, a good salad, unfinished wood, and turmeric. Her bed remains unmade.
Thank you. So that's from a little book that I put together for tonight. Amanda Cook Is, which is a collection of six fantastic biographies. So if you'd like one, they're on the back table. If you have a couple dollars in your pocket, put it in the jar for the Writers' Center. That's all there is about that. So I'm going to read from two very different pieces. Both are making me incredibly nervous right now. The first, my mother suffers from early onset dementia, which for all intents and purposes took her from us very early. And so I've started to think about what her voice is, and I've settled on the house, on our house being her voice. So I'm going to start with that. This is a prose piece about the house. The sun came in through the windows of the kitchen like smoke under a door. It hung in the air. The air was so still, and fell as it wished on what it wished. The mug on the table was bathed in sunlight, its turquoise brightening to almost white with the glare. Beside it, a newspaper sat, unchanged by the light, untouched. The water on the counter glistened, but the sink was dark. The pitcher of wooden spoons nearly turned amber with the glow, the tin of coffee obscured. It was late afternoon. Soon the whole room would fall into shadows. It would be easy to say the kitchen hadn't been cleaned in some time, but that wasn't the truth. It had been cleaned constantly, horribly, ineffectively. A film of black soot covered the bottoms of the percolator and the pots and the pans. It rubbed off on anything they touched. The sink was smudged with black, and the mugs had black smudges, and the counter and the table. Black smudges everywhere. The wet rags by the sink were marked by the soot, and everything they touched was marked, too. The stove was black and blackening. It was the stove that made the soot. 20 years old, bought from a restaurant supply store, the stove needed to be cleaned, serviced, made right. In protest of its poor condition, it sent the black soot to cover everything. Above the soot were cobwebs. The top shelves of the kitchen were dripping in them. As the sun sank, it would catch one here, throw a beam of light into another. The corner by the basement hung with a curtain of cobwebs suspended, it seemed, from more cobwebs. They clung to the spines of the old cookbooks, which hadn't been used in years, and to the jars of things that hadn't been touched for years, and they clung to boxes of old forgotten food and photographs peeking out from between the books, and the newspaper clippings and the wooden pig painted with two different pinks and the old tins. Between the soot and the cobwebs was a layer of greasy dust. It could not be cleaned with a dry cloth, and it would not come off with a wet cloth, so it stayed there, sometimes smudged, growing thicker with every day. There was a cleaner part of the kitchen, from the stove to the sink. Cleaner, but not clean. The dishes on this side were marked not by grease and cobwebs, but by a combination of meals past that had never been completely washed off, and coffee grounds and soot. The glasses were washed to the point that they looked full of smoke. A can of something was open, a pot of something left out. An empty bottle of dish soap sat by the sink. It could have been empty for years. Cups of coffee dotted the counter and the table and the sink and the stove. A couple were near empty, traces of coffee hardening to a crescent in the bottom of the mug. Some looked like they had been poured and forgotten immediately, but most were half drunk, the milk turning, sitting on the cold surface of the coffee, making circles or clouds or patterns that looked like the wind. There was a cat on the table, or the ghost of a cat, or the memory. There was cat hair on the table. There was cat hair all through the house. It hid in the corners and gathered in balls and stuck to any surface that was wet or sticky or thick with dust. It was not so much in the parts still used, but in the forgotten parts it gathered, grew, formed a halo that glowed in the afternoon light. There was no part of the house as forgotten as the back room upstairs. The stories of that room were piled one on top of another. As full as the room was, it felt as empty as it was forgotten. That emptiness was the first story and the last story and a part of each of the stories in between. The room had been empty for several years in the beginning, save for a stool and some boxes that would never be unpacked. She would sit in that room and cry. Or maybe the room had held a bed and a dresser and drawers full of things and some boxes that would never be unpacked, and she would sit in that room and cry. That history was as forgotten as the room. At some point, the floor had been painted with glossy black paint and tiny purple flowers. It was a labor of love. A bed for a little girl and a vanity to sit at and a shelf for favorite things were moved in. The little girl moved in, and her brother and sister moved into the middle room, and the mother moved into the front room upstairs where all the children had been before. Even with the girl and the bed and the shelf, the room felt empty, and even after her dolls and books and clothing filled the corners and the floor, it stayed empty. It was a lonely room. No matter what was put in it, the loneliness hung in the air. Even when the wind rushed through, or a cat slept, or the children played in it, the room was lonely and empty. And cold. It was the coldest room in the house. In the winter, the little girl would sleep with as many sweaters and nightgowns and blankets as she could find. When she woke in the morning, she could see her breath and she could etch her name on the frost on the windows. On the coldest nights, she would leave her room and sleep on the floor in front of the wood stove downstairs. After the girl grew up enough that she could move away, the boy moved into the room. The dolls that sat along the shelf at the top of the room were put into boxes and moved into the attic. Antique trucks and fishing reels and boxes of baseball cards took their place. The vanity was replaced by a fish tank, its filter slowly gurgling until the tank was forgotten and the water fell so low that the motor whirred as it moved air into the tank. In the bottom of the tank, an eel sank as low as it could, in a foot of water, then half as much, then just enough, then an inch, until it was near death and the tank was filled and forgotten again. And the boy grew up nearly enough to move away, and he left too. He took some of the loneliness of the room and left some of his own. For some time, the room waited for him to come back because he was not grown up enough to leave it, but it was too lonely for him. All of his things waited just where he left them. An open book on the unmade bed, CDs on the floor in broken cases, a crust of bread, an old pinball game. Only the fish tank changed it all. The water evaporated until all that remained was the skeleton of an eel and a rock green with algae and the whirring of a motor moving air. After some time, the pump was unplugged and the motor died. A cat spent the night locked in the room, then another. A basket of fabric was tossed onto the unmade bed. A box of unopened mail and papers and little things left around the house that were quickly cleared when someone came to visit. An old rug, a book of ornamental patterns, a box of single shoes. Years of old coats were stuck in the closet. A tent, a set of dishes, the manual to a vacuum cleaner, a wooden box filled with marbles, a tube of white paint, a stack of children's drawings, a letter from an old friend. The woman and the man, there had been a man for some time now, put things in the room. Things they couldn't be bothered with, things they couldn't bear. The room became so full it was hard to walk in. As the room filled, it spilled into the next room until both rooms were forgotten by everybody in the house, excepting the cats and the dogs who would visit the rooms when the woman and man forgot about them. Some time before the soot covered the kitchen, and the woman decided which things she wanted to forget. She stuffed them into the corners and under the couches in between piles of laundry. She took the things she thought had been holding her back and put them in boxes of broken toys and old newspapers. She picked up a sketchbook, and she picked up her pens, and she went to draw the world. The stories inside the house changed as they waited. The pipes in the drawer of the cobbler's bench were first her grandfather's, then her ex-husband's, then the man's before becoming her grandfather's pipes again. The red shoes were on sale downtown, then given to her, then found on the beach. Each thing lived a life of its own, then another, and another, without anybody but the woman ever knowing it. Nobody asked her, and nobody listened when she told them. The driftwood could have been from the day she swam with the seal, or washed up from the storm that took six fishermen, or it could have been from a camping trip to a distant shore. Nobody knew. So there's the first one. And as they say in the business, now for something completely different. A while ago, we tossed around the idea here at the Writer Center of starting a reading group for Charles Olson, but only for women. And the idea was exciting and horrifying. And I thought, I should probably deal with Charles Olson myself, since I've kind of left him over there for a long time with a lot of feelings about him that aren't necessarily based in his writing. So I picked up the Maximus poems, and I decided I would read one and write something, and read one and write something, and I couldn't move on until I'd written. It was a horrible idea. It's probably ruined me. And I apologize to anybody I offend with everything I say, but I'm going to say it anyway. This is my dealing with Charles Olson, my letter to Maximus. 1. I am reading your poems. It isn't that I haven't read them before, but I am reading them again, this time with care and attention and all the other words in my eyes. I am trying to make up with you, forgive you, as if you need my forgiveness. I am trying to mark the edges of your shadow so I can see where my Gloucester falls in it. Scholars can stop here. This isn't for you. 2. I am taking liberties. When the poem makes me think of the kitten we buried on 10 Pound Island because there was no land available to us at our first apartment on Mason Court, I will write about it. About how the woman downstairs wouldn't let the pregnant cat in when the storm was howling outside. About how we let her in and she gave birth, and when the storm was over, she went outside and came back with a kitten, soaking wet, too weak to nurse. We warmed it and fed it with a dropper, and it died. 3. By ear. I have listened to men talk about you more than I have listened to your words. I am sitting in Vincent Farini's house reading Catherine Bayliss's copy of the Maximus poems. I am leaving Butterick in the legal box on the daybed. 4. Born. It occurs to me just now that I was born via C-section. I wonder if my grandfather delivered me. I wonder if he delivered Charlie. My own daughter wore your granddaughter's pants to school today. This is the form I take these days. Wash, fold, cook, clean. That, too, is a form of love. 5. Love is not easy. My closest friends growing up moved away. My closest friends now came to this place from somewhere else. That is a lie. There are some from here and some who stayed. But it is not easy. 6. It is raining outside. I don't want to prove myself to you. Poetry is so much a game of one-upsmanship these days, and my list of victories is weak. I can tell you, I have cooked for and cleaned up after some of the best one-upsmen of our day. One night, I left them in my kitchen, talking, and went squid fishing at the state fish pier. We drank wine and ran from the big dock down to the walkways between the boats and up again. When we got home with a couple pounds of squid, they were still talking. We pulled garlic from the garden and cleaned the squid and cooked it, and we called a Norwegian cab driver to come over, and between the poets and the cab driver and the squid fishers, we each had a few bites to eat. Letter 2. Someone recently said in an argument I was part of that Maximus was a fishing poem, and there didn't need to be any women in a fishing poem. She's never seen the women set up with their novenas or watched them throw confetti at St. Peter out their windows in the fort. Letter 3. Tansy. When I was young, my stepmother would lift me into the trees they had planted in the line in Stageport Park. I remember so clearly sitting there feeling invincible and so separate from everything below me. So much tansy. There is something about riding the bus. I took the bus to and from Lanesville so often the bus drivers still waved to me. One day, Mrs. Muncie took off all her clothes and sat naked on the bus until her stop. This rare thing, this Gloucester, is a choice we make. My children were born in Beverly. They don't deliver babies at Addison Gilbert anymore. On the day I brought my Abigail home, we walked to the top of Governor's Hill and looked out over the city, over the harbor, past the breakwater. I was so sore and tired, but I had no food in the house and didn't know what to do with the family visiting to help. So we walked up the hill with the new baby in the stroller, and we walked down the hill to Mike's to get subs. You should see the sign at Mike's. We call it Mike's because there are too many S's and the apostrophes are everywhere. I laughed when I saw Summer Sun. My first published poem outside of school was in the Summer Sun. I was a young poet, 19, I think, and you're in it. The poem, I mean. I took projective verse out of the library that summer and read it over and over before returning it to the library. It was a big summer for you, too. They put on quite a show in your honor at City Hall. Pregnant women should avoid tansy. It causes contractions, can bring on labor or abortion. It makes the mouth wet, tansy. Someone wrote years ago about the gentrification of Gloucester because he had seen well-planted flower boxes on the houses in the fort when he was looking for your place, as if the people of the fort don't like flowers, too. I should say something here of the islands of men and girls. I hardly know what to say. Song 1. I see so much of myself in these pages. In my book that never came out, insert Corbett Wiener's joke here, I ended, words and pictures, we put them everywhere. When I say I love you, you think I am selling you soap. Song 2. This, too, the bodies. Sometimes sitting still in chairs, eyelids flutter. I am in a cafe now, with my own copy of your poems. I should say my husband's copy. The big book full of notes on little pieces of paper. The music here is all wrong. There should be no music. Song 3. Growing up cold, growing up not knowing how or where the other kids got their clothes, happy with the adventure every so often to the Madras shop in Rockport or the flea market in Rowley, growing up on the bus or on foot, growing up never asking, having held my babies close to keep them warm when we were out of oil, and you standing alone, fly gaping. Song 4. I don't know what takes more strength than keeping a home while the men go out and waiting, knowing they may not return, and waiting, praying for fish. Song 5. Apples. Song 6. How can we keep from singing? Letter 5 for Ariane. I had to walk away from this one. I had to walk away. If a poet pisses into the wind, I believe one can be a good writer and a good person at the same time, though some seem less concerned about this than I am. Who are you to say what Gloucester needs? I don't call myself poet any more than I call myself dishwasher or teacher or cleaner or cook, and much less than lover or mother or daughter or friend. I put as much care into a pot of soup as I put into a poem. On Thursday mornings, I work with children, turning their words into poems. More often than not, they say, I love Mama. Maybe what this island of men and girls needs, maybe what this city has, when poets posture and men go out to sea, is mothers. Thank you. Thank you guys so much for coming. Have some cake.